This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 74. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I just finished eating tacos.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What is the word this week, sir?
Tacos.
I can tell. Did you make them at home or did you go out?
No, my wife made them.
Good. When you're in Massachusetts, that's the best way to go. I'm a bit of a taco snob, I think. I think being from the West Coast or the Southwest, it's just a whole different ballgame. So, hey, following up with our episode last week about how to deal with a service outage, you and I had talked quite a bit on air about some minor issues that the Academy had been having over the past month, and we finished the move to WordPress Engine. I'm so stoked about that. First of all, the Academy is like 5 times faster.
Yeah, it seems a lot faster. The speed checks to just the HTML pages are, I think, 4 times faster.
It's just awesome. So, I'm stoked. I mean, obviously, we've only been on there less than a week, and so downtime is not an issue, and hopefully won't be an issue for a long time. My blog has been on there. I don't know. My blog's been on WordPress Engine for maybe 4 or 5 months and haven't had any downtime, but it really is that speed thing. They have a CDN built into it, content delivery network, so it actually makes all your assets load faster. They have caching built in. There's just lots of cool stuff. So, I mean, full disclosure, I always say this. I'm a very, very minimal investor in WordPress Engine, but I'm so far just impressed. The more I move over there, the more I think I want to move more sites over there because of how fast and responsive it is.
Yeah, it's definitely noticeable. I mean, people, when we switched over, were commenting about how quick the forums were, and it seems to me like there's been a lot more activity in the forums as well. And I think it's related to the speed increase, to be perfectly honest, because people just didn't want to wait before. And I agree. I can't say I blame them.
Even if it's subconscious, like I've been responding more to the forums, right? And like I should have been responding the whole time, but it actually has drawn me back in because stuff loads so quickly. It's like an easier process. That's it. If someone was in the Academy before and they quit because it was slow, definitely give us a shot again. In terms of the iTunes competition with TechZing, it looks like both of us got a pretty big bump. I don't know if iTunes like re-indexed something or what, but we went from, we were around 124 last time we checked, and as of today, we're at 147 iTunes reviews. You know, most of them are 5-star, which is cool. And then TechZing's at 92, and I think they were somewhere in the 80s last time we checked. So still a good friendly competition. We've now surpassed, I mean, our original goal was, I think, 125. My original goal, as you like to say. But it's great. I mean, we have 6 more weeks till MicroConf. We're still trailing. There's no competition, but Lifestyle Business Podcast, I think, is 200 and something. They're in the low twos.
Yeah. So
those guys are really kicking butt.
And I haven't checked to see if their numbers are based on just their U.S. subscribers or worldwide.
Yeah. So. I'm not sure. I think Dan mentioned that they were using the same script we had. So I think it was international as well.
Got it. Yeah. And they would have a much larger international audience, I think, than we would just because of the things that they do.
Right.
I finally finished all of my taxes this past week. So before I was just working on all the business taxes and stuff, and now my personal taxes are done. And I don't know about you, but those checks are just painful to write.
Seriously. It's just like, how can my bank balance drop that much? You know, and then I feel like I spend the next 2 months just trying to generate money to kind of backfill and get back to where I was before writing those checks.
Yeah. And then the worst part is that because I don't know about you, but I'm going ahead and paying, every quarter because of the quarterly taxes and everything. And then at the end of the year, because the estimated taxes don't match up with what you actually made or what you brought in, it's just, I don't know, it seems like a never-ending cycle.
Yep. Yeah, now you're right. In April, you write not only your year-end taxes for 2011, but then you write your estimateds for 2012 for that quarter, right? That's what you're saying. So you actually double up on the checks in April.
Yep.
And a substantial amount. I actually had to, 2 years ago, funny story, I didn't have enough money to pay. And so I actually sold one of my portfolio pieces, one of my websites, to pay part of my tax bill. It was such a bummer.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I have not even started, but I have it on my schedule to look at taxes this weekend. And then I'll know the pain of how much I actually owe.
I was listening to some of our really old episodes, and I think it was like episode 7 or 8 or something like that, where I had mentioned that I put up a website for my wife. It was called digitalartsilhouette.com.
I totally remember that. Yeah. Well,
it came up for renewal, and she finally said, "No, I'm not never going to actually do anything with that. So just get rid of it."
Right. Yeah. As Dan Andrews says, their GoDaddy account is the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. That is the best way to describe it. When I log in, there's a bunch that I'm excited about, and then there's probably 20 or 30 that I'm like, "Oh, good Lord, I never had time to build that."
Or what was I thinking?
Yeah. Yeah. So depressing. I will go through probably every 4 to 6 months. I'll go through and just check a bunch of them, and you can delete them out of your account, and it just releases them back into the wild. And you really got to think about that before you do it, because it essentially means someone else can come along and snag it. But I do that just to declutter my account. I don't buy nearly as many domains as I used to. I bet I only have a handful that I haven't put into play at this point, but it's a kind of an addictive habit to think of something and then jump on and want to buy the domain real quick. It's only $8.
Well, I think the other part of it is that a lot of times when you go out there, and I think we've talked about this before, you search for a domain name, and there's some registrars out there who kind of watch what those queries are. And if you don't get it within like 24 hours, they will get it, and then they'll try and sell it back to you. Yeah. Basically, they would put a registrar lock on it for 24 hours as if you were going to register it. And then if you didn't, they would take it or keep it or whatever, in the hopes that you would come back.
That's like a conspiracy to get you to register domains.
I know. Yeah, I think it's no longer allowed by the by ICANN, but.
So I had a couple interviews go live last week. I was interviewed on Mixergy for the first time. I listened to it. It turned out better than it felt. For some reason, I was really like stressed during the interview, and I'm normally not nervous or anything, but I listened to it. It was good. I think it conveys kind of my story. Probably it actually talks about businesses that I've never talked about anywhere else. Talks about my stream of failed businesses from 99 until about 2004, 2005. Folks are interested in hearing about that. We'll link it up in the show notes, but I think it's, you know, one of the top couple on Mixergy right now. And then the other one is on Blogcast FM, and that's actually more information about growing a blog. I think it's called like How to Grow a Blog to 20,000 Subscribers or something. So it's less about the startup and more about, since Blogcast FM is geared towards bloggers, it's more about that side of things. But if folks are interested, they can check them out. So hey, MicroConf, 6 weeks away.
Yep, that's a little scary.
I know it is. So good news. Obviously, we're sold out, which is, you know, really taking a burden off of us in terms of both the financial risk and just having to put in so much time like we did last year into marketing, constantly trying to sell tickets right up to the end. So that's been good. But it's crazy. I've forgotten how much time this takes. And I should listen back to last year's episodes, but I was just talking to my wife and I said, you know, I'm not sure again why we do MicroConf. I totally said that last week. And she's like, yep, you're just about on time. I was like, I don't know if I'll do it again next year, because I'm right at the dip, you know, where like investing way more time, we're not getting any payback, not even financially, but just in terms of like emotional payback or anything. And I'm on the phone with the hotel, trying to get the menu, trying to get layouts of the space done, getting AV stuff, trying to fill the last speaking slot. I mean, just all this stuff, and there's no reward yet, you know? And then of course, on May 2nd, right after the conference is done, I'll totally be like, hell yeah, Mike, I'm doing it again next year.
So. 6 weeks. It's one of those things where you look at those last 6 weeks and there's still a lot of work to be done before we can even start to reap those emotional rewards that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So speaking of MicroConf, though, we do have a couple of new sponsors to announce. One of the sponsors is GitHub. Most people are probably familiar with them. And the other one is WildBit. And WildBit is actually going to be sponsoring Monday night. And we don't have a lot of the details worked out yet, but they're essentially going to be sponsoring the evening gathering for Monday night. And if you've never heard of WildBit, they have a couple of different products that they have. One of them is called Beanstalk. It's basically a hosted version control, code review, and code deployment service that makes it easy for an entire team to collaborate around designs and code in their projects. And then the other one is Postmark. And we actually use Postmark to help us send emails from the Micropreneur Academy.
I have like 4 websites using it now. Love this, sir. This is actually one of the reasons I love MicroConf, is that we can get sponsors that I'm really excited about. Like, I'm really passionate about their service because I use it and I'm so in love with all the value it gives me.
Right. Yeah. Postmark is awesome. I mean, it allows you to see whether or not an email is actually getting delivered or not. It's basically for transactional emails. So unlike MailChimp, where you're kind of throwing things over the wall and, you know, you're blasting out an email to an entire list of people, Postmark is designed to allow you to single-handedly see whether individual emails are being sent, you know, whether they're getting bounced or not, et cetera. And it keeps logs of all those things, whereas whether MailChimp or AWeber, you don't get to see all the logs behind each of the emails and whether it got sent or not, or whether it got received or not. With Postmark, you do. And you get to, you know, see the deliverability ratings of all those different emails. And it's really nice to be able to see that stuff, but you can integrate it into, you know, any of your different WordPress hostings or any of your other applications as well.
Right. And MailChimp is made, it's more of an end user thing that you enter an email list, then you enter an email and you click send and it sends it to all of them. Whereas Postmark, there's really no UI. You don't actually enter email text in there. It doesn't do mailing list management at all. It's really just an API that you would call for either from your code or from your SMTP server. When I do like my billing receipts, any notifications from Hittail, they go through it, you know, with the Academy and a couple other apps I have. So yeah, it's definitely increased my deliverability. One of the things I love about it is that it shows every email sent. So I got an email from someone asking, you know, saying, you never notified me during the trial. And I just grabbed their email address, went into my Postmark admin, and I searched, and I could see all the emails that had been sent to them. And I could view all the emails with exactly the text from all of them. So I told him, like, they must be in your spam filter. Here's what to look for. And I've never logged emails, so I never had that power before. And, you know, it's $1.50 for 1,000 emails. It's such a no-brainer. Like, I will never go back from doing this. Well, that's cool. That's exciting. All right. So this week, Mike and I are going to update you on what we've been working on. We haven't had an update podcast for, it's been maybe a month or two, and we've been working on a bunch of new stuff.
So, I don't know. I feel like I'm juggling half a dozen to a dozen different things at the moment. And unfortunately, it's one of those situations where none of them is so unimportant that I can just kind of drop it on the floor and come back to it later. I mean, all of them are, I think, pretty important to kind of keep at least moving a little bit. So I've got, you know, all this stuff dealing with MicroConf. There's all this minutia that you have to deal with. For example, you know, dealing with the sponsors is just one side of it. But there's also things like filing to get insurance for the event, you know, getting workers for the conference. You have to deal with getting the swag straightened out for the giveaways and door prizes and things like that. So there's all these little things, and a lot of it takes the, you know, manual intervention. It's not something that you can kind of deal with later because, as I said, MicroConf's only six weeks away. A lot of it's just time sensitive, and there's a lot of pressure to make sure that these things are done and on time. So that's kind of interfering with a lot of the other things that I have going on as well. I also have the Audit Shark desktop edition that I've been working on, which I haven't really talked too much about that. Basically, I built Audit Shark as more of a platform for you to pipe data results into. Well, one of the things that, you know, the way that it's built now is that it's all web-based and you install this one little piece on your server and it will pipe the results out from your environment into the cloud. Well, there's a desktop edition that I'm going to be shipping for a kind of a different classification of users. And before, what I've really focused on for the web version is customers who want to run Audit Shark internally in their environment, so that if you want to get your audit results on a regular basis, you install this in your environment and it will pipe the results out to the cloud and you get your reports. With the desktop version is essentially aimed at consultants who do these audits on behalf of other people. So it solves the same basic problem, but the usage scenario is completely different. And the way it needs to be, quote unquote, deployed is completely different as well, because you generally can't take a web application and put it on somebody's laptop and have them go into an environment and, you know, use it that way. I mean, there's a lot of little things that need to change in order to make that work. But the data results all get stored in the same place. They all get piped up back out to the cloud.
And so is there a particular market that you're going after with this, or was there like an impetus to start building this?
It's related to the first one, because I think when I had talked a lot about Audit Shark before, I probably had in my head was to go after the IT auditors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of focused in on them as the target market. But I think I've come to realize that that's probably not necessarily the case for the smaller businesses. And obviously it was a mistake on my part. I built the web edition essentially with that in mind. And I've come to realize that I don't think that that's going to fly for smaller companies. I think that it works well for the large companies, but not necessarily the smaller ones, you know, the companies that are under 200 or 300 employees. So those companies tend to have somebody come in like once or twice a year, and they'll run an audit, and or they'll give them a package that they then have to run on their systems, and then they take the output of that and give it to the auditor. But that auditor is an outside consultant, so they don't necessarily want the outside consultant running stuff in their environment. They're more than happy to take that stuff, look at it as long as it's text-based, and then be able to run it in their environment and then give them back the results again, as long as they can look at those results and see what they're essentially handing over.
And so do you have an outside auditor that you're working with who has expressed interest in this or who is going to be able to use it?
Two of them.
Okay. Yep. So they're your customer zero and customer one. And do they know that you're building this? Have they looked at screenshots or anything? Yep. Do they know what you're building?
Yep. I've had extensive conversations.
Awesome. So essentially you have two quote unquote customers. I mean, they wouldn't be buying from you directly.
What'll happen is this, the consultant auditor that I'm working with, his business is around going in and doing these audits. So what he would do is essentially he'd go into a customer and say, I'm going to come in, I'm going to do an audit, here's how much it's going to cost, and I'm going to audit 50 of your machines. Well, in order for him to audit 50 machines, he has to get the licenses from me that's going to cost $250. So he will build that into his consulting fee to the company, and then I get the $250 because he's, you know, it's $5 times 50 machines, and then, you know, he can go in and do those audits, and he can go back and do them as many times as he wants in that 30-day window. And one of the things that he'll be able to do is he'll be able to take the policies that he builds inside this desktop edition, essentially build a compiled or standalone executable from it, and then the customer can run that in their environment and then hand him back the results, assuming that they don't want him to do it directly. And there are cases where some customers will say, yes, go ahead and just run this from your laptop. Other customers will say, no, give us the stuff that you want to run. We'll take a look at it, and then we'll look at the output, and then we'll give you that stuff. So in order to get all that functioning, it needs to be done in a different mechanism than the web edition. But as I said before, I built the web edition more as a platform and in some ways as a proof of concept, but you know, it also as a functional product.
Right. So you're back to development. Is that what you're saying? I mean, you're basically digging into the code and building a desktop viewer. Is that right?
It's kind of a desktop version of it, but you know, slightly different market, solves the same basic problem. And the nice part is that with this desktop edition, I can actually couple it with the web edition, such that if you want to build a policy, you can just use this little desktop edition as well. Because one of the issues that I found with the web edition is that when you're building these policies in the cloud, in order to test them, it's a real pain in the neck. It's just not very feasible to do it that way because there's not this constant connection between the servers that are out in the cloud and the customer environment, because the customer environment, it pulls back to the cloud and says, hey, do you have anything for me to do? Yes or no. And, you know, it's a periodic basis. It may be every 5 minutes or something like that. So if you make a change in the web, if you want to try and run that in your environment, you can click the button and it's not going to fire until the machines in your environment reach out to the cloud and pull that task down.
Right. Okay. So I think the question in my mind is how soon, how quickly can you turn this around? Because obviously if you have two folks you're talking to, the sooner you get something in their hands, the better. You're going to show it to them and they're going to say, well, this isn't quite what we wanted. And you're going to have to make adjustments and stuff. So what's your time to beta?
Oh, I don't have a time to beta.
No time to beta. Uh-oh.
No, I have a list of 35 things that need to be done in order to finish it off.
Wow.
Yeah. But they're very specific things. Let's say that I was able to get one done per day, I could have it done in 7 weeks.
All right. I'm holding you to that. All right. So you're back to working on it.
Yep. And again, this is more, I guess I would call it an extension of the original product.
It's a pivot. It feels like, it's not even a pivot though, right? I think because you still have the same core product, you're putting a different UI on it, and you're going after a different market. Because before you had thought about banks, and now you're more thinking about outside auditors. And if you have these two people these two companies who are interested in it, then you do have beta customers. I think pivots are a larger swing, and this is just a marketing shift is what it feels, or a market shift.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's included as a pivot or not.
I feel like it's more of a, I probably missed the mark in terms of who would actually pay for it. So like the problem being solved, I think it's still essentially the same thing, but I feel like I missed the mark in terms of who would actually pay for it. You know, somebody will pay for it because it's a problem that needs to be solved. It's just, I think I got it wrong when I was going after the IT directors. I really feel like it's because they contract with an outside company to come in. That's what they're doing. The reason they do it is because they want somebody with that expertise to come in and tell them what they should be looking at and what sort of things that they're doing wrong.
Yeah, that and that's the thing. In the diagrams I've seen of kind of the lean startup, it's problem solution fit is one, and then product market fit is two, and then scale is step three. That's the simplified diagram. And so, I mean, last time we talked, it was, you know, what, 10 episodes ago, I was saying, I don't even know if you have problem solution fit. But at this point, if these guys are saying, yes, this solves a real problem for us, these consultants are, I mean, you haven't built it yet, but at least you can get problem solution fit or at least get it in your head before you build anything. You should do that. And it sounds like you're at that point. So as long as you build something that does actually solve their problem that they have, then you'll have stage one done. And then you're right. It sounds like you've more pivoted on that stage two of finding the market. Well, cool. Thanks for the update, man. Yeah, I'm sure listeners were curious, but I was also curious about what you're working on in terms of AutoTruck.
Mm-hmm.
I'll pop in here with my Hittail update. I mentioned it briefly last week, but essentially, when I first acquired it, I had lots of ambitions, as you naturally do. And when I relaunched it, I had this goal that 6 months from relaunch, I would hit a certain revenue level. And so 2 months after relaunch, I was not on track to hit that level. And I realized that I started stressing out pretty hardcore about it. And I started staying up late and work until 2 a.m., you know, and I get up at 7 with the kids. And then my shoulders, my back started to hurt again. I mean, I was frankly working too much and stressing about it. I found that there were two reasons. One was I'm doing too much. Like I had 13 things that I'm working on. Literally, I wrote them out, you know, including my blog and newsletter and microconf. And I was selling a house in L.A. And so what I've done, I did two things. One, I started eliminating pretty heavily from that list of 13. And so the house is now sold. I'm not going to write any new talks because I've been doing, you know, some speaking gigs, but now all my talks are written. So that's off the list. I'm putting my book on hold until after MicroConf and a few other things that I basically really pared it down to just doing email, my blog, and Hittail, and the podcast, and a couple other things, which still sounds like too much. I would prefer...
That is a lot.
I know.
And I thought my list was long.
But I can't not... I really want to do the podcast. I enjoy the podcast. You and I have to do MicroConf at this point, right? We're committed. But I can't just abandon the blog either. So there are these things that I have commitments to.
The nice thing about MicroConf, though, is that in 6 weeks, it's essentially over. After MicroConf comes and goes, that essentially drops completely off your list. I mean, that's a done deal. Yeah. It's not like it's a product launch where you've got ongoing marketing efforts afterwards.
No, and I totally agree. And that's actually why looking at this goal that I had, it was July 9th that I had to hit this number. I'm just like, what was I thinking? You know, it's that whole like eyes bigger than your stomach thing of not looking realistically at everything I had planned. Because MicroConf alone is a couple of months of part-time work. I mean, it's 2 to 3 months of several hours a week. And that, it just bites into that schedule. So yeah, I was checking some of my time logs and I, you know, I think I put in like 7 hours on Hittail 2 weeks ago because I traveled to LessConf. I wrote a talk for a Fresno thing. I mean, it's just stupid to think that I could possibly grow it to where I wanted it to be in that amount of time. Hittail is growing, like revenue is increasing. It's just not increasing as fast as this initial goal that I had set. And it was really causing me some anxiety of doubting whether I was going to be able to pull it off. And so that's what I did. I mean, I talked to my wife. She said, write out everything you're doing. And once I saw that list, it was just like, this is unbelievable how you can fool yourself basically into thinking that you can do more than is realistic. And so that's where I'm at. So one thing is I started hacking and slashing and I went from 13 and I think I'm down to about 7 or 8. The other thing is I just backed off that revenue target and I'm going to push that. I still want to hit that revenue target, but I'm probably going to push it another at least 4 months beyond July and I may push it all the way to the end of the year. And the interesting thing is the only reason I set that goal initially was to motivate me. Right? Was so I had something to shoot for because I really don't need, I mean, I don't need the money from Hittail to live. I don't need to do it. And so I wanted to have something to motivate me. And it was actually, it had become a demotivating factor because I was so kind of honed in on it, tunnel vision on this thing.
And I've done this before myself. I think that you set a goal for yourself and then you start to mentally realize that there's just no way that you're going to meet that. So you almost think of excuses to do other things.
Yeah, it's like I didn't want to face the music, you know? And again, the music, like, it's not public. It's not like I committed in public. Hittail's going to be at X by July 9th. It was totally an internal thing. Like, three people in the world know the number, you know? And so it really has no consequence. And yet, mentally in my head, this was hanging over me. I was feeling stressed out and anxious. And I was like, why am I feeling this? I haven't felt this in years, right? Like, I typically, aside from doing microconf stuff, like or right before a talk or something, my life is pretty relaxed. I don't have a boss and I don't have hard deadlines for the most part. And so I was like, why am I feeling so weird about this? And it's because I had set up this weird deadline that was intended to do good and was actually negatively impacting me. I mean, one of the big problems is I traveled to Atlanta to speak at LessConf, and then I wrote this other talk. So I, like, 2 weeks were almost chewed up entirely. And then as soon as all that ended and I started relaxing about this, I like had my first big milestone in a long time where I kind of had some major projects I was working on with regards to Hittail, like getting the blog set up, getting a blogger set up to start blogging on it using our suggestions. Boom, that's done. Like, as of today, she's starting and I'm super stoked about that. It kind of feels good to push the reset, do a reality check and say, what is going to make me more productive? Stressing about this thing all the time or working on this as much as I can and trying to hit my milestones. So, I mean, today was actually a really good day. I got the whole blogging thing set up. I've started mapping out the next feature. And these things have been on this list for like 5 weeks. I really haven't made much progress. And that's why I was getting frustrated. All of a sudden, you know, once I get over this mental hurdle, essentially, things are breaking loose pretty quick. And a developer that I was hiring on Odesk and kind of vetting just came through with some stuff. And so today he'll be starting on the next thing. And so it really does feel like it was this dip. And my hope is that, you know, over the past like 7 days, it feels like a lot of things have started to break through. So optimistic about the future.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of things on my list that I'm hoping will start to clear off a little bit. I mean, one of the other things that I've got going on is, I think I'd mentioned my forum software a while back, and I've had a developer who's been working on that, and he's actually pretty close to finishing it. He says the end of this week. I think it's actually going to be next week, but I think that by the end of next week, I'll probably be able to relaunch it and, you know, see what happens from there. And then hopefully that whole project will taper off a little bit, and I can focus a lot less on it.
Right. Well, development's wrapping up, right? And then marketing's going to start.
Yeah. The sales website is actually the part that I've taken on. So I've been working on that while he's been working on all the code for it. And then I'm in the middle of doing a sort of an infrastructure upgrade as well, because I've got my Windows server. It's still running Windows 2003. I'd like to upgrade that and put it on Windows 2008 and kind of upgrade the hardware, because the hardware hasn't been upgraded in, you know, a couple of years at this point. So I'm still paying the same amount for a piece of hardware that if I were to get a new subscription or a new service, it would be much better hardware.
Does that matter at this point? Like, is it slow?
It is. It's at a web host. It's at 1&1.
Okay, cool.
I'm looking at Rackspace right now. I actually just signed up for them and I'm going to be moving some things over there and seeing how things work. And if it works out, then pretty much move everything off of that box.
Right. That was part of my dip with Hittail, is that we were trying to do some stuff with the database. We were clearing some data out and it was... It's a long story, but it basically costs a bunch of money because it's metered. It's a metered SAN, depending on how many disk operations you do. And so I was asking what our options were, and they were saying getting a dedicated box. And so that would mean basically all the work of reinstalling the OS, configuring IIS, getting all the code moved, everything configured. I was going to have to redo all that and moving the database again. It was within the same data center this time, so it wouldn't be the end of the world. But we spent weeks doing that before, and I was so frustrated hearing that. That was another reason that I was feeling depressed. We're not going to do that. We found a way around it. But all this infrastructure stuff, it just feels like such a waste of time to me. Customers don't care and don't know, and so it's frustrating because it does not move the business forward one bit. It's not a new feature and it's not a new marketing approach. This stuff kills me. So this is probably my, aside from like taxes and paperwork, infrastructure stuff and dealing with hosting and stuff is by far my least favorite part of what we do.
Yeah. If it were just a performance issue, I probably would just kind of let it go for the time being. But this server is close to 4 years old at this point. And, you know, at the time, Windows 2008 was out. So I had the option and I said no. In retrospect, maybe that was a mistake, but a lot of the stuff that I had running on it at the time, it actually didn't even have the option to run on 2008, so it wasn't really a mistake. I just didn't have another choice. But at this point, some of the new stuff that's going on it, has problems running because it is Windows 2003. So I almost don't have a choice but to upgrade at least some of it. I mean, so one of my options is to just get a new server and not bother touching the old one or migrating anything. And that's something I actually may do. I may just pay them the $60 a month and just kind of let it go for a while. But eventually I'm going to have to bite the bullet and move stuff off of it.
Well, yeah. And is there any way you can, because I would think about outsourcing that. That would be my first thing. Like, unless it's super complicated to set up and it's going to really require you to get involved. If it's just moving websites and databases and it's fairly straightforward, I would absolutely find like a sysadmin or even a developer to help with that if you think it's possible.
It probably is, but the problem is that I want it done quickly. I mean, if I had started 3-6 months ago, it probably would have been different, but I literally just right. found out this past week that, you know, that server was going to have problems running this new code. So
right.
I just don't have time at this point.
Okay, well, I don't have any other updates, Ed. Did you have anything else you wanted to mention?
I have one other project that I've actually been given the green light to go ahead and start implementing. A lot of the consulting that I've been doing or have done over the past several years is with a couple of very specific software products. The company that I've been doing a lot of the subcontracting through essentially just gave me the green light to build a online tutorial website where people can come in and essentially pay a subscription to be a membership of this of a website, very similar to the micropreneur.
Wait, yeah. This sounds familiar.
Yes, it does. it's the same concept.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like throughout all the consulting I've done, I repeat myself every single time. And it's so incredibly frustrating and to have to go over the same things over and over. So, you know, the concept I came up with and I essentially pitched it to him and said, look, this is what I want to do. I want to build something where I essentially say it once, I record it, put it in a video or a screencast and charge these customers to come to the website and they can get a monthly or yearly subscription or whatever. And it will basically teach them all the things that they need to know and serve as a reference library for them so that if they have a question about something, they can just come here. And essentially what I'll be doing is I'm going to cross-sell some of their stuff and they're actually going to cross-sell my video library as well. So I think it'll work out pretty well. I mean, I don't have a timeline for getting that done. I've already talked to somebody about doing all the audio and video editing and everything else for me. So more or less, it's a matter of me just sitting down and building my lab up again so that I can record these screencasts and then recording them and then sending them over to the editor and then posting them on the website.
Well, I mean, that's the beauty, right? Is at this point, we have infrastructure in terms of people who can edit this stuff. You have knowledge of how to, probably how to set this up. Are you going to build it on WordPress with the plugin, or are you going to go for some other avenue?
I haven't decided. Yeah, it's a tough call just because of, you know, some of the issues we've had in the past with some of the plugins and keeping them up to date yeah. and everything else. It's a pain point. And I know that there are other options out there, like Ning is one option that I've kind mm-hmm. of contemplated, but I think I want a little bit more fine-tuned control over what the content is.
I think you do too. Because I think Ning is more of a social network.
It
or a it's I guess it is a membership site, but yeah, it's more of a social network, and I don't think that's what you're going for
not,
here.
It's not.
I can't imagine, yeah, building the academy on Ning. It would be it'd be a very different experience.
Right. So I'm thinking I'll probably end up coding it either myself or outsourcing the development of that to somebody. But I don't think that the infrastructure needs to be fairly extensive for it. I mean, basically, it's going to be one or two pages or three pages for kind of the sales website area. And then there's going to be a bunch of video links that are embedded into it that once you get through that paywall and you log in, that'll be
right.
it.
I don't think you should code it by hand. I mean, you can do the research, but knowing what I know at this point, I would say that WordPress with a plugin is going to be your best bet.
Yeah.
You know, we use Wishlist in the academy. We have run into issues with it, but I think one of the reasons is because I first installed it. It was like just out of beta, and then we've upgraded for 3 years now. It was a very young product, and I think that we've had problems because there's a lot of data in there, and because it's, I mean, just upgrading over 3 years really tends to leave some legacy crap in there. So my guess is with a fresh WordPress install and a fresh Wishlist plugin or an A-member plugin, you would be much better off than trying to write it yourself.
I think I can get away without those because I think that the number of subscribers that we have in the academy is significantly higher than the number of subscribers that I expect to be on this, but the price point is different. So the price point will be higher, and I could probably justify having somebody just go in and create accounts and manage that stuff by hand, at least until I figure out what to really do with it. And that'll help me get it out the door quicker.
Right.
Because the vast majority of my time is going to be spent building these videos. They're not going to be long videos either. I mean, they're only going to be 2 to 3 minutes apiece. So, but I just have to build a lot of them.
Right. All right. Well, I think that about wraps us up for this week. We have a few listener questions on deck, and we'll probably cover them in episode 75 next week.
Sounds good. If you have a question or comment, you can call it in to our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. We're trying to get to 250. And you can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. A full transcript of this podcast is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.